All right, if you've listened this far, you know the deal. The book that came out of this podcast is called How the Internet Happened, From Netscape to the iPhone by me, available wherever fine books are sold. Also, the podcast I do these days is called The Tech Meme Ride Home. Search any podcast app for Ride Home, and you should find The Tech Meme Ride Home, which is all the day's tech news every weekday in just 15 minutes. If you like this show, you'll love that one.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Welcome back to the Internet History Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Brian McCullough. So, as sometimes happens on this show, for this episode, we're going to skip ahead a bit in our narrative and talk about some people and technologies that we haven't mentioned previously in our overall timeline, but that we'll certainly get to in a short period of time. But because we're going a bit forward in our timeline here, I did want to lay out some of the background so you know what we're discussing and who we're talking to in this interview. iVillage, which you're probably still familiar with as a brand, was actually one of the very first early web community sites. So early, in fact, that in a way, it grew out of a consulting gig with AOL all the way back in 1995. Robert Levitan, the man we'll be speaking to today, was one of those consultants, despite having little previous experience with the online world, as he'll tell us. Levitan, along with co-founders Candace Carpenter and Nancy Evans, both of whom I hope we'll be hearing from shortly, went on to launch iVillage and turn it into one of the very first sites to engage with women as a segment of the online audience. In iVillage's success, we can see, arguably, one of the early proto-social networking sites. But Robert also went on to launch Flooz.com, the most prominent of the dot-com era companies that attempted digital payments and digital currency. So start this episode by listening to learn how a consulting gig for AOL turned into iVillage, and one of the biggest IPOs of the dot-com era. But stick around to hear how, oddly enough, the Russian mafia and massive online fraud conspired to make Flooz one of the highest profile casualties of the dot-com era. And then stick around to the end to hear how all of Robert's experiences in business have seemingly led to and coalesced into his soon-to-launch new startup, LiveApp. I'm sure you're going to enjoy this exceptional conversation with Robert Levitan. Robert Levitan, thanks for coming on the Internet History Podcast.
Great to be here.
It's also great to do another one of these in person. It's somewhat rare. There's a lot of people on the West Coast. But actually, are you a New York native?
I am a New York native, and I can't believe that it's been 20 years of doing tech startups in New York, and finally, VCs don't ask me if I'm moving to California.
Is that a recent change?
Very recent. I'd say the last 3 to 4 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've raised a lot of money over the years. People have asked, when are you moving to California? I will say that while New York has become a great tech scene, I'm also able to admit that there are significant differences between the New York tech ecosystem and the California ecosystem. And, you know, each is known for its own thing. But trying to build consumer businesses in New York, like iVillage or Flooz, those were hard, because California definitely is bigger on the consumer side. New York maybe a little more B2B.
Well, we'll definitely get to all that, because I also. You know, the whole concept of the beginning of Silicon Alley, you know.
Yeah.
Let's get to all that stuff. But one of the things in my research, you know,
most of the people that I talk to start out as entrepreneurs very early on. And tell me about this yearbook enterprise that you and your brother, was it?
No, it was actually Yearbook.
Okay.
And so I happened to be, I was always fascinated by media, actually. My twin brother and I actually, you won't find this, published a newspaper and a yearbook in our public elementary school in New York City.
Okay.
Which is crazy.
Right.
At college, I ended up playing with the student TV station and running the student TV station and playing with video, and I hosted a show called Late Night with Lev. And then I got this idea. People were starting to buy video cameras and VCRs, which, by the way, was Sony Betamax and VHS. And we had this idea to produce a video yearbook. So at Duke in 1982, we produced the world's first video yearbook. And then I started a company called Yearbook Enterprises, and we worked with high schools and colleges around the country. Students would shoot video. Mm-hmm. I would train them to shoot video. Then we'd edit it together and package it into a video that would be sold to students and parents.
You would edit it for them?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it was a crazy...
Seems labor-intensive.
It was labor-intensive, and then digital... It was still a kind of linear process, mm-hmm. and then things were starting to go digital. But at that point, actually, people could do it all themselves. And actually leads into kind of how I got involved in the internet. After running that company for 10 years, mm-hmm. it was a long time.
84 to 94, basically.
Yeah, right? Yeah. I was kind of living comfortably in Durham, North Carolina, running a nice video production company. But I realized I wanted to do something more challenging. And I also realized an important business lesson. You have to choose your customers carefully. And sometimes schools and school administrators aren't the best customers. You know, mm-hmm. they want the best price, but they're the best product, but they don't want to pay, et cetera. So the bottom line is I came back to New York, and I didn't know what I was going to do. And here's the kind of crazy truth behind how I got it online and how we started iVillage, if you want me to jump
sure,
in.
Sure, yeah, please.
So January 25th, 1995, I believe it was a Wednesday, and I was speaking to Candace Carpenter. Candace Carpenter had gone to business school with my older brother, and I was telling her I'm back in New York trying to figure out what to do, and she literally said to me, what are you doing Friday? Well, I had no plans. Mm-hmm. I was like, I could be available. She said, would you fly down to Vienna, Virginia, and sit in on a meeting with me at a company called America Online? Mm-hmm. And I looked at her and I said, well, that sounds like fun, but I've never been online. And Candace said, that's okay. You come anyway. I was like, all right. So what did I do? Well, I called up two friends who I knew had a Prodigy account and mm-hmm. AOL account. I went over to their house. I checked out what online was about. And on Friday, I went to a meeting, and they were designing the first shopping screens on AOL. Mm-hmm. And I had a few opinions. At the end of the meeting, Candace said, okay, I want to hire you as a consultant. You and I are going to advise Ted Case and Steve Leonsis. I'm sorry.
Steve Case and Ted Leonsis.
No, no, no. I know that. We're going to involve Ted and Steve.
Yes.
We're going to consult with Ted and Steve. And we're going to have an office right next to them. And we're going to tell them like what revenue models can be developed that are not based on time, charging people by the hour to use AOL.
So
Candace and I.
Commerce, things like that.
Commerce, advertising, okay. Other things. So it ends up. And by the way, you know, Ted was really the driver of this. I mean, Ted Leonsis was he was recently there. They acquired a company called Redgate that Ted ran. And Ted was really shaking it up. I mean, Ted was really trying to kind of breathe a lot of life into AOL. And it was happening. I mean, people were moving in. The doors were wide open. And they were literally moving in desks like it was a college dorm room. This is in Vienna before they built the Dulles campus. So Candace and I spent...
How was Candace, she was already consulting for them?
Yeah, so Candace had been running a part of QVC called a shopping channel, Q2.
Something like that.
And for Barry Diller. Mm-hmm. She had been running that, and Ted had met her, and Ted said to Candace, you know, why don't you help me at AOL? Why don't you help me figure out, why don't you run shopping at AOL, but you got to move down here? And I think Candace said, I'm not moving down there, but I'll help you figure some things out. So Candace and I would fly down there and spend a few days a week down there and a couple of days a week here. And one of the things that we did is, I remember, and this was how we ended up founding iVillage, is we looked at where were people going at AOL. And I don't know if you saw on my blog post that why we started iVillage, there's a blog post on that, but on my blog. But anyway, it says we looked at kind of how many times per month people visited and how many minutes per visit did they stay at all the different content areas on AOL. And what we discovered is there was this direct correlation between the places that had the most visits per month and the most minutes per visit, and those that had the least minutes per visit and the least visits per month. You know, so the ones at the top were all original programming connecting people to each other. It was The Motley Fool. It was gay and lesbian, forums. It was health information, where people were talking to each other about things in their community.
I was going to say, another word for that is community. Those are topics that lend themselves
to
people.
It was all community, and Ted would say that AOL was about community, content, and commerce, was what Ted would say the early part of AOL was about when he was there, when he was building it. You know, I mean, Steve actually was there before Ted, but when Ted was building it in the late 90s. So what's interesting is what we realized, Candace and I, is that we've got to go build online communities. And that was why we started iVillage, to build online communities. Now, they had a thing called the Greenhouse then, run by a guy named Danny Krifscher.
Within AOL.
AOL. And what they would do is they would give $100,000 or $200,000 to some young entrepreneurs, and they'd create content to put on AOL. And Steve and Ted knew that was great for members, and Motley Fool was actually a Greenhouse project.
Right.
And Candace told Ted, we want to start a company. We want you to give us $1 million. And we're not going to do it in Vienna. We're going to do it in New York City. And we're not going to only be on AOL. We're going to be on AOL and the web. And AOL was a walled garden then.
Right.
And sure enough, Ted, being Ted, said, you know what? Okay. But I think you're too old, Candace. Now, Candace was probably in her early 40s.
She's what, about 10 years older than you, maybe?
She's probably 5 to 7 years.
Okay.
I think I was in my mid-30s at the time. I think I was like 35.
I think
Candace was maybe 40 or early 40s.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so Ted knew how to challenge Candace and get her motivated. He said, I think you're too old for this, but prove me wrong. So we then set out, and we were not a women's network. I mean, here's one of the great mistaken kind of historical facts about iVillage. People think it always was a women's network. We started as a company that was building online communities, and the first community we built was a parenting community called Parent Soup. Then we built a community called About Work, which was about career. Then we ended up buying some of the health community stuff on AOL, the chat rooms and message boards called Better Health, and we had a health community. So we were about parenting, career, and health information. Now, as we grew, and my role was to sell advertising on top of that, as we grew, we realized that 80%+ of our audience was women. And when you aggregated up our reach of women, we were the number one destination for women on the web. And that's how we packaged it up.
Well, let's stop and examine a couple pieces of that. So did you ever actually develop pieces for AOL, or did you end up only doing the web stuff?
We did both.
Okay.
We had, so Parent Soup launched with a Parent Soup destination inside of AOL and a website.
Were you kind of cheating a little bit and giving more attention to the web side than the AOL side? Or
no, you know, early on, this is actually a great question, because early on, there was more traffic inside of AOL than on the website.
95, absolutely.
Right. And the other thing, well, we launched in January of 1996. We started the company in the summer of 1995. But the other thing that was interesting about it is, in those days when AOL was still charging by time, AOL paid the content providers, like us, money based on a share of the revenue they were collecting. Now, they ended up switching the model and asking the content providers to pay them, because we were selling advertising, and they said, wait a second, we're shifting from pay per hour to a free model, and AOL is going to start selling advertising, so you guys pay us for carriage and audience, and you can sell advertising too. But so anyway, we made more money on AOL at the time, but we kind of knew the future was open and web and not going to be in a closed environment. And by the way, when we started, there was Apple had a...
E-World.
E-World, mm-hmm. Exactly. And Netscape and AOL. And they were kind of...
CompuServe.
Yeah, CompuServe, Prodigy had their thing, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's also mention, so Candace is the CEO when this launches. There's you, and then there's Nancy Evans and Tina as well?
So Tina was employee number 8.
Okay.
But she does call herself a co-founder.
Okay, and that's Tina Sharkey.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But the three founders of the company were Candace, Nancy, and myself.
And so, again...
And Candace was the CEO. Mm-hmm. Nancy was responsible for all the editorial. And Nancy had come from...
Publishing
background. And then myself, and I had been an entrepreneur, and then it's interesting how I landed in the advertising.
Well, let's get to that. But one more thing. So, again, to be clear, you're not choosing... You didn't do any market research. You're not choosing these sites based on anything other than... Well, the parenting site worked out. Work works out, so...
Yeah, I think Candace would say that we were building communities around the things people care the most about. Mm-hmm. That was our line. We're going to build communities around the things people care the most about. It was parenting, career, and health. That's what we thought it was. Now, before we get into it, there is one interesting story about the name iVillage. Because we had an I long before Apple had an I. Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, Apple had E-World.
Right.
And a lot of people are using an E. Now, I'm going to admit this for historical accuracy, and we'll see if the people from iGolf ever listen to your podcast. But here's the story. We were sitting around. We were thinking about parenting and parent soup and we were thinking about the name of the company, and we were thinking about in a village and the village green where people get together and talk in the middle of town.
I also thought of Hillary Clinton had that book, It Takes a Village at the time.
Now, we didn't really, I don't remember talking about, although I think Candace and Nancy might have talked a little bit about It Takes a Village because they were parents. And they got that. But we were talking about village and the word village and about people in a village, like helping each other. And at AOL, there was indeed a greenhouse site and an area on AOL called iGolf. Hmm. And I said, why don't we just iVillage? And that's how we came up with the name. And I remember when NBC bought iVillage years later, when iVillage was public,
right.
I remember telling that to executives at NBC who didn't even know it. But that's where the name came from. We just stuck, I actually copied it from the iGolf and said, why don't we call it iVillage?
Well, and then there's a bunch of other things that become i. And
well, after that, now there's a lot of i's.
Yeah, exactly. So one more thing before we get to what your role is. What is the product as it launches? Is it message boards at the launch, not later?
Right.
Are you paying for people to write content for the site?
This is a great question. So we thought we were doing something so radical by creating these, you know, Parent Soup was our first thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, but I'm going to ramble and tell you how we came up with the name Parent Soup, because it was a really hot day in August of 1995. And we had an office at what is now Chelsea Market. Mm-hmm. But somebody I knew had bought the building. They were fixing it up. It was abandoned. Mm-hmm. There was no market there. The neighborhood was really rough.
Right.
We had a space there. I think we were paying $6 a square foot. You know, it's now 50, 60, who knows what. And it was really hot. And we were talking about parents, and it's kind of like you're in this stew with all this good stuff and the bad stuff is on. I'm like, stew, it's too hot for stew. I want cold, like gazpacho, like a cold soup. And we came up with the idea of be Parent Soup. And at the time, there was a show called Talk Soup.
Exactly.
We ended up having to write to them and say, Candace knew them. And so Candace's like, do you mind if we use the name Parent Soup? And they're like, okay, you could use it. But that's the name Parent Soup.
Well, then let's use Parent Soup as an example, because I have an 11-month-old at home. So I'm a new parent in 1996. If I stumble upon Parent Soup, what do I find?
Happened is we launched with a website and an AOL site that had a menu on the homepage. And the homepage had this menu that said different categories. You know, education, health, finance, sports, different things about parenting. Mm-hmm. Now, I had sold a bunch of advertising before we launched, and we'll talk about that. Mm-hmm. What we realized is we thought we were doing something so different, but oh my God, we did the exact same thing as a magazine. Mm-hmm. We had like a table of contents, and we asked people to pick the content they wanted to read. And we thought that if you clicked on health and you would then read about health stuff related to children, and then you'd want to talk to other parents about it. So it was an article followed by mm-hmm. links to what we call message boards or chat rooms. Mm-hmm. And then each topic would have, here's a message board and here's a chat room. Like every Wednesday at 8 p.m., we're going to talk about health and children, whatever. Well, what we quickly found out, and this was our aha moment in early online communities, is nobody wanted to read the articles and then connect with other parents. All they wanted to do was connect
right.
with other parents who were just like them. And we thought we were building something great for the web and unique to interactive, mm-hmm. but we learned the lesson the hard way. Now, well, how did we learn it? We put all the advertising around the articles. Mm-hmm. And we had no impressions. Mm-hmm. And I had pre-sold all the ads. And I had to go to the advertisers, most of whom didn't even have a website. We built their website. I had to go to them and say, I'm sorry, we thought we were going to deliver all these, but we didn't. We're re-architecting the site because all the traffic is around the chat rooms and message boards. Mm-hmm. So then Parent Soup quickly became, the homepage quickly became, are you expecting parent? Mm-hmm. Are you the parent of a newborn? Toddler, mm-hmm. this age, that age. So once you identified yourself, then we immediately put in front of you all the other parents, all the other connections to all the other parents, and the articles that we had written or sourced became support material to the community versus the other way around.
Were you
that
able,
was a key insight.
Was a user able to claim a username or an ID, a profile in that sense?
Yes, you could. The users that really cared about their kind of ID mm-hmm. were what we called community leaders.
Okay.
So, you know, let's say there was a chat about a health issue for newborns and some mom who dealt with a lot of health issues for her child would be, you know, healthy mom, you know, and she'd be the head of that chat group or message board or whatever and maintain it. But it wasn't required mm-hmm. to have one, but some of them had names, yeah.
Well, okay, then let's get to what your role is. I think it was Advertising Age or somebody at the time described you as the rainmaker for
yeah.
for iVillage. And so reading some of the details of the deals that you were able to pull off early on were yeah. amazing, but you didn't necessarily have the background in this, right? I mean, I suppose you did right. selling in your previous company.
No. The reason I was so successful at selling advertising online is that I didn't come from the advertising business. I didn't know any better.
You didn't know what you couldn't do.
Right.
Right.
I didn't know any better. So I just went out and sold it. In fact, true story. So we were interviewing, Candace was interviewing for a head of sales. And she interviewed up and down Madison Avenue at the time, which was the ad. And we interviewed a fellow named Greg Stewart. And Greg Stewart went on to be the head of the IAB, the Internet Advertising mm-hmm. Bureau, which was put together then. And he was at like an ad agency. He didn't want the job. We interviewed a guy named Doug Weaver, who was running ad sales for Wired magazine mm-hmm. at the time, mm-hmm. both their magazine and their website. And interestingly enough, Doug, and I was in on these interviews, Doug ended up telling Candace, like, you know what? Candace, you know, I'm not going to take the job. You're not going to find anybody in advertising who really gets what you're doing. Robert gets it. Just let him run with it. So lo and behold, Candace turned to me about mid-November 1995 and said, we're launching in January 1996, and I want you to go out and sell ads at $40 CPMs. Why? Because Yahoo was selling $20 CPM banner ads. I want you to sell $40 mm-hmm. banner ads. And I want you to pre-sell the whole site. In 2 months. And a month and a half.
And you actually did.
Yes, we did it.
Now, how did you do that?
So we pre-sold $500,000 of ads. Mm-hmm.
And to Fortune 500.
Big brand names.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll tell you how we did it. So first of all, we did bring in, as a consultant to help me learn the ad business, a fellow by the name of Dan Ambrose, A-M-B-R-O-S-E. And Dan actually now has a business training people in ad sales stuff. But Dan taught me a little bit about the ad sales business and what we had to do. So we put together a presentation. Now, I have to tell you, it's so funny because you read now and you read about the, you know, share of advertising, like the eyeballs online and are X, but the advertising online is still less than X, whatever, so the market is going to continue. Okay, well, we did a few of these things first before anybody. So the first thing we did is we identified a bunch of companies that we thought would be great, and we went out and we told them, look, there's this thing called the internet, and the people who are on the internet online, people on AOL and on the web, are higher educated, more affluent, and they're going to spend more money on your brand. Now, how did we figure that out? There was no research at those times. What we did is we took people who bought computers with modems were on average higher income, and And so we showed advertisers, we're going to have this audience. Then we showed them a demo of our site. And frankly, they had never seen anything like it. You know, it's. And then I said to them, look, we've got five slots. That's it. If you get in early, we'll give you the right to renew, category exclusivity. And you know what? We're going to be your partner in this new thing called interactive media, the web, online. So partner with us, learn with us, grow with us. And I just didn't know any better. Mm-hmm. So we didn't even have a pipeline of like 20 companies. I mean, I think I spoke to 8 and got 5. Mm-hmm. And the first 5 sponsors, I mean, Polaroid, Toyota, Starbucks, let's see if I remember them all, Nissan, and MGM Home Video. Now, there were a lot of others that came. We brought on, you know, Johnson & Johnson. We brought on companies that had never been online. We did early stuff with Procter & Gamble. But of the first 5, this is going to amaze you. Polaroid, MGM Home Video, and Starbucks did not have websites. They had no online presence. Toyota and Nissan had a website. They each had. Now, Nissan did soccer content. We created the kind of like mommy soccer league information stuff with American Youth Soccer something and Nissan minivan. You know, Toyota just did some general advertising. But MGM and Polaroid and Starbucks, we built content for them and stuff that you would now call content marketing. So I remember Polaroid did, every week we did an example of how to build self-esteem with your children by taking a Polaroid camera photo of them when they did something great. So your kid scores the first soccer goal in their career, whatever, or they score a goal, or they go to the potty by themselves, take a Polaroid photo of them, not the, you know, and then show it to them right away and you'll create confident kids. For MGM Home Video, we literally featured an MGM Home Video every Friday and said, this video, you should watch at home, Friday, family video night. You should watch this video, and if you give us your name, we're going to raffle, you know, like 100 of these videos. We're going to ship them to you, a video cassette, to your home. And for Starbucks, we created a whole thing about community. So, yes, we created advertising, and we just didn't know any better, so just went out and sold them.
As listeners of this podcast know, the guys at Hotwired had the same story. No one had websites, so part of the ad sales deal was we'll create content with you. But also like you, they said a similar thing where you called it integrated partnerships, but what people call it now today would be native advertising.
Right.
And in a sense, that was the instinct of what to do early on.
Yeah.
And then somehow, I guess, everyone forgot about that, and we got the lazy banner ad model or something. That's later.
Right.
But what you're talking about is what we would call now.
You know, it's funny you say that, because at iVillage, as banners got more prevalent and the prices of banners went down, we continued to say, no. Work with us because we're more than banners. Mm-hmm. And when we built out Better Health, we were selling $200 CPMs. Why? Because we were building like interactive health assessment tools. Take this quiz and we'll tell you how you score. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were doing, you know, big brands like Zocor and, you know, big pharmaceutical drugs were working with us to identify people who were interested in, you know, different topics and, you know, conditions that were relevant to their. And it was, you know, Glaxo and Burroughs Wellcome and, you know, Johnson & Johnson, whatever. And we were getting a lot more revenue per impression because it was more than just a banner ad. It was some interactivity. But, you know, then it went all banner ads because it was efficient. And now it's back. The advertisers are trying to figure out how to.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and also thinking back now with what you know, was there a little bit of you were the right people at the right time? Not only because brands are suddenly in 96 willing to experiment with the web, but also from my discussions with AOL people, I feel like people were getting a little wary of AOL. AOL was getting super powerful at this point.
Yeah,
and so the web offered them a way.
It's very interesting that we offered them AOL and the web. They
right.
love that.
Right.
Wait, I can buy from you and be in AOL and on the web? Mm-hmm. Definitely. But, you know, we were the right people at the right time. But we also didn't realize, and now you can look back, we didn't yet have the tools we needed. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't have social media tools. Mm-hmm. We didn't have media tools, period.
Did you have analytics of any kind?
No, so it's funny. Let's talk about analytics. I mean, it cracks me up. So I will tell you, we had to count the ads.
Right.
And nobody had ever counted ads because right. no one was serving ads.
Right. There were no ad servers.
We hired a young guy named Steve Gold. I think he was 24 years old. And Steve and I figured out, well, the way we can count the ads is, you know, every page view, there's an ad on the page, and we just tie it to the page views, and we'll assign every ad impression to every page and then count the page views and build the ad view, whatever. So we did this. So we had our own system for counting ads. Mm-hmm. Now, it you know, of course, DoubleClick came along, and right. all these systems came along. Steve Gold ended up becoming the longest-running iVillage employee. Mm. I believe he stayed 18 or 19 years. Hmm. So he was at iVillage the whole time, ended up running ad ops, ended up going to NBC Universal, running ad ops for NBC Universal, and just left about a year ago. Hmm. But isn't that amazing? Like
yeah.
he ended up, you know, seeing it all. But that's, yeah, we didn't have the systems to count ads. We didn't have the systems. We were building communities. We didn't have photographs.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't send us a photograph or a video of you yourself. You know?
Mm-hmm. Well, right. And there's no digital photography.
There's no digital photography. Yeah.
Okay. It's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Well, so it does evolve from these separate sites into it eventually goes under the
right.
iVillage.
Yes.
Is that for branding purposes? It's easier.
It's both for branding purposes. It goes under the name iVillage and for positioning. You know, we could sell more ads across a bigger audience. And lastly, position to go public.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it just, we were a very large destination online when you added up everything we were doing. And we were the largest destination for women.
Mm-hmm.
And it was nice positioning. I actually was running our health site, Better Health. You may remember Andy Grove at Intel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think he had colon cancer or something. And Intel became a big sponsor of online health stuff. They gave us money to develop some of our interactive health assessment tools, and they gave money to a little company called WebMD.
Right.
And we were bigger than WebMD, and I said, you know, to Candace and Nancy, I said, I think we should take the health thing and blow it out and become like the biggest health destination online. And they said, well, we can't because we're going to go public and we need the traffic and the revenue and everything that's associated with health as part of iVillage. And lo and behold, you know, WebMD ended up becoming a big company in this space because that's a big opportunity. But it worked out fine for iVillage. I mean, you know, running up to, you know, the IPO, everyone thought, you know, we were going to price this thing at $12, end up getting priced at $24. It went at $100 a share on the first day. It was a crazy thing. So, you know, iVillage was maybe the first billion-dollar New York internet IPO. I don't know. I'm trying to remember.
When did DoubleClick go? Or no, GeoCities.
GeoCities was more California-based, but right. I'm trying to think. iVillage went in the spring of 1999. Uh-huh. Went public in 99. There was another in New York. I'm just trying to remember who. But iVillage was certainly one of the first. And it was worth $1 billion after the IPO. Now, of course, you know, it was worth 20% of that 8 months, 9 months later. But, you know, it fluctuated greatly.
We hadn't mentioned any of the competitors. There was Women.com at some point, and then eventually Oxygen with Oprah gets involved. And
so this was fascinating because, you know, Women.com was Hearst was involved with Women.com, and Hearst had a lot of conversations with iVillage, and we could just never figure out how to work with Hearst. They ended up being involved with Women.com. They ended up merging right before the IPO. Women.com merged into iVillage. And then Jerry Laybourne, you know, Bob Pittman was at AOL now, kind of maybe took over Ted's position. And, you know, and I don't know the exact titles, but, you know, Steve Case was always running it, but Ted was a driver for a while, and then Bob Pittman came the COO and the driver. And I guess Bob knew Jerry, and Bob wanted them to have a woman's thing and not just iVillage be it. So apparently started Oxygen, and, you know, and Jerry was doing that. And, yeah, we never really felt a lot of competition from Oxygen or Women.com. We were clearly the biggest, but it was definitely of concern. I mean, you know, Hearst is a real player, and Jerry and AOL owning Oxygen. I mean, you know, and Oxygen was more focused on TV, probably a little more TV than online, although they had online. But yeah, I mean, they were there, but never really
taking your crown, I guess.
Not really. I mean, we felt it, and but you know, market was still growing for everybody. You know, more people coming online every day, more women coming online, and more advertisers coming online.
Since you mentioned this, and it's hugely interesting to me personally, but also to listeners, and the idea of Silicon Alley as a maybe a marketing creation, but I've spoken to the Razorfish guys about this and the DoubleClick guys about this. And when did you get a sense that there was a scene, a tech scene coalescing in New York?
Well, it's funny, you know, I joke about in 1995, there were probably 200 of us in like internet tech in New York, and now there's 200,000, you know. You know, we knew probably in 97, 98, that there was a real tech scene here, and certainly 99, things were going. I don't think we put it together and did enough as a community early to enhance that image. And then 2001 happened. And I think everybody was just so busy dealing with their own fires. The Valley was much better at building, you know, they had obviously earlier successes and then building community around it and a support network. And they had the big thinking venture capitalists. And, you know, we didn't really have great VCs. There were some young, new VCs in New York, but there weren't many of them.
So you would say that, that most of the people that, that raised capital in this period were raising from West Coast?
Well, there were some New York investors. I mean, you know, there was Flatiron Partners. There were some new ones like RE and DFJ Gotham and, you know, there were some others. There was Roe Ventures. But I remember at iVillage, I mean, we went out west. I remember, I think we were the first East Coast investment for Kleiner Perkins. Mm-hmm. At Flues.com, I went out west. We were the first East Coast investment for Redpoint. You had to go out there when you were going big. You know, you were going past your early round. You know, you were doing a Series B at that or C, and you were trying to grow, and you had to go out to California or Boston. Boston was a big town for VC. But, you know, I think we just didn't, I'm not sure we fully appreciated. Now I look back, and there's probably 15 or 20 people that I knew in the mid-90s who have all gone on to do interesting things, who are in the tech scene, and I'm still in touch with, and kind of in some ways, you know, reconnecting and doing things with. And I appreciate them because it was a different time, and it was a great time, and I loved that time. And what I loved most about that time and those people, which I think we've lost a little bit of, is the sense of anything's possible and let's try it. You know, we've gotten to the point where everybody's so smart, everybody knows better, and it's very easy to, you know, here's all the reasons that's not going to work. What we had back then and what we did in the early days of iVillage is, yeah, we didn't really know what we were doing. It's true. And because of that, we just went and did crazy stuff. We went and did things that people said couldn't be done, like selling $500,000 of advertising, you know, before. I mean, I remember when Kleiner made an investment in Sportsline. They sent the Sportsline guys to our office in New York. I remember when AOL hired Meyer Burlow, which was an ad sales guy. They sent him to our office in New York. They all want to know, how are you selling advertising like this? I was like, I don't know. This is what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. You know, then a lot of our stuff ended up in their presentations, which is cool. You know, just the way we were positioning things. But anyway, I love those days. And I like the people from those days because there was something else that went on. If you were doing tech in New York from 95 to 99, you were doing it because there was something about it you just loved. It wasn't about the money. You just loved doing this. Then it became a lot of people, like, you know, wanting to be in the scene because it had become hot. And that's fine, but I always, when I interviewed people and I'd say, so why do you want to work here? And someone would say, well, you know, it's the thing to do. I'm like, okay, gone, you're out. But, you know, those early days were people who really wanted to invent things. And there were, you know, people left, right, and center who were literally, you know, inventing ad tech, inventing, you know, online content, online communities, inventing online customer service. And I could name you some of these companies. Some of them are still around.
Right. Well, just for the interest of time, it was also a compressed time period, if you think about it, because you guys launched in January 96, the IPO's in 99. You leave right around the time of the IPO, right?
Right
before?
So technically I left right before. I was still involved through the IPO, but I left right before because I saw e-commerce coming. And I wanted to be a part of it, and I thought I saw something that was probably a little too far ahead of its time. But a friend came to me, and we had this idea that, you know, you should be able to have a stored value account, essentially an e-wallet, an electronic wallet online, and you should be able to use it at different stores, and you should be able to replenish it. And in a world of digital information and e-commerce, you know, you should have this digital wallet. And so we came up with this. A company ended up becoming Flues.com, F-L-O-O-Z.com. And, of course, Whoopi Goldberg was a spokesperson. And, you know, it's your birthday. I don't know what you want. I send you $100. You have an account. You go shopping online. And we would clear transactions directly with the merchants. We were the first form of payment at checkout other than a credit card. And we were not using the credit card networks. We built our own electronic wallet and clear transactions. And by the way, this drove Visa and MasterCard crazy.
I'm super interested in this because not only I feel like this is a problem that for 20 years people have been taking a crack at it, like things like cyber cash at the beginning, like everyone's trying to make money digital, right? And now with obviously Bitcoin stuff. So your model was completely around the credit card system?
So our, yes. I mean, our model was, you would come to Flues.com. Now, you'd use a credit card to buy Flues.
Right.
Now, I would send you a gift with a greeting card, a happy birthday card, a whatever card. And then you'd have an online account with us. And you'd have $100. If you want to spend it all at one store, spend it. You want to spend part of it at this store, part of it at that store, great. Now, the key to our thing was we ended up signing up about 50 stores. But we tried to just do early, like one store in a category. So Barnes & Noble was the book supplier. Tower Records was the music supplier.
J. Crew.
You know, yeah, J. Crew. I think we had Toys R Us. Anyway, the bottom line is we directed a lot of people to these stores. And instead of getting 3 or 4% credit card fee, we were getting 10 to 15% of a transaction.
Okay, so
because we were like a new customer acquisition platform.
So the merchant is paying, your cut is what?
So here's what would happen is you'd come to our site because you were just given $100 of flus. We would show you, here are the merchants you could spend it at. You'd link over to Barnes & Noble and you'd go buy something. And at the end, by the way, at the bottom of the screen, there'd be your little account that showed you how much money you have. At the end, it would say, how do you want to pay? And Barnes & Noble had us as a form of payment. Do you want to pay Visa, MasterCard, American Express, or flus? Mm-hmm. And you click flus, and then just click how much you want to take out of your account.
Right.
And when you click buy, instead of going to the credit card companies, they would go to us, clear the transaction, and then at the end of the week, we would forward the money to the merchants. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this was radical at the time. Sure. Nobody had ever done that. We went from 0 to 30 million in sales in 18 months.
Right. It did $3 million in 99 and 25 in the year 2000, I read.
Right. We were at a run rate in 01 when we were closing it. We were past the $30 million run rate. But yeah, we did 25. Yeah, it was you know, humongous. But we ran into a few problems.
Right.
You know, and it started with, and it's fascinating. I mean, by the way, you mentioned Bitcoin. I have to give Mark Andreessen credit. Mm-hmm. Mark Andreessen came to our office in 2000 at flus and talked to me about digital currency. Mm-hmm. So when, you know, he talks about Bitcoin, it's not a Johnny come lately thing.
Right.
He was interested in digital currency in the year 2000.
Yeah.
So anyway, so quickly, what happened to us? I actually was on vacation for my 40th birthday skiing in Whistler with my two brothers, and I got a phone call from our CFO that about half our business was corporate, where companies like Cisco would give their employees flus instead of giving them a color TV or a trip to Hawaii. Mm-hmm. And half our business was consumer. And Cisco called us and basically said, we had a bad quarter. We're cutting back. This is April 2001. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were supposed to buy $8 million of flus, and we owed you like $4 million in the next 8 weeks. And we're only going to take $3 million, what we already paid you. Mm-hmm. We're not paying you the rest, or whatever. And we were like, all of a sudden, our biggest corporate customer, which represented, you know, 15-20% of our, maybe 20% of our revenue, 25% of our revenue for the year, wasn't going to pay us. And so anyway, I had to come back from vacation. We fired half our staff. Mm. I mean, it was like $3 million some dollars in like the next 8 weeks that we weren't going to have. It was like, oh my God, you know, we can't. And then, but we survived it and we kept going along. And then we got a call from the FBI. Mm-hmm. And the FBI said, listen, we're following this Russian mafia gang. They're stealing the U.S. mail credit card data, bills. Mm-hmm. They're taking the credit card bills, which at the time had your name, your address, your phone number, the full credit card number.
Right.
They're shipping them to these computers in Russia and they're laundering them through flus.com. They're
never it occurred to you that that would be...
Long story short, our fraud rate went from less than 0.5% to 19%. Uh-huh. And Chase Merchant Services, which was processing our credit cards, started charging back the money. But then they said, you know what? We're going to freeze your account for 6 months. Every transaction, we're going to hold the money for 6 months. And now remember, Chase was then, you know, working with Visa and MasterCard, and Visa and MasterCard were big associations of banks. They hated the idea that flus.com was there in payment. Anyway, they squeezed us, and, you know, we kind of survived Cisco. We survived the Russians, but we couldn't survive the bank credit cards holding all of our money because without any cash flow, we couldn't pay our merchants.
So
we ended up closing flus, bankrupt, Chapter 7 bankruptcy.
And the bankruptcy wasn't directly caused by the Russian mafia fraud stuff. It was more of a chain of events.
It was caused by the fact that our cash flow was frozen by Chase Merchant Services.
And I had read most of the articles I found were at the time where they were describing that this could potentially be the largest bankruptcy in history in terms of the amount of creditors, because all these people...
So it turns out we had something like 300,000 accounts that still had some balance in their account. And I think on average, the balance may have been 20, 25 bucks. So we had 300,000 people who were literally owed money because they had money at a Flu's account. Now, there were also some merchants who might have been owed money, but I mean, we made the payments every week to merchants, so maybe they were a week or so behind. But it was the largest bankruptcy ever in terms of creditors because there was over 300,000 creditors. Now, we did not have everybody's address. So it turns out this is the first time ever that email was allowed as a legal means of communication in a bankruptcy to creditors. First time. So now, the very strange part, of course, is that the last day that I did any work at flus.com was September 10th of 2001.
First day you were without a job, I thought 20 years or something.
So I wake up, first day without a job. Actually, I remember September 10th because we went to go meet with the bankruptcy trustee. It was pouring rain in the afternoon. I mean, just pouring rain. And went meet with the bankruptcy trustee. I was soaking wet. Me and my CFO went. And then woke up September 11th. It was a beautiful, clear day in New York because the rain had washed everything out. And it felt very quiet. I walked over to the gym. I didn't know what to do with myself. I walked over to the gym, and there it was on the TVs. And I watched the second tower get hit. And so... obviously, you know, we were front page, New York Times, business section, Flu's bankruptcy. They didn't get everything in the story right, but, you know, they got the story, and it was ugly, and you know, I felt terrible. But then September 11th happened, and I mean, you know, easy to get perspective on what we're dealing with. And it turns out, just to end the story, that we had had a bankruptcy hearing scheduled where creditors come forward and you kind of try to, you know, with the trustee, and you do this in a courtroom downtown. And that was scheduled for October, and it didn't happen, you know, because all the buildings were closed. I think maybe by the end of November, the court was open and we had a hearing, and nobody showed up, not one creditor. Now, of course, a lot of the 300,000 people who have individual accounts might not show up, but some merchants that we owed money to should show up. Nobody showed up. I think the world, it was just so... And the bankruptcy trustee was like, wow, that's interesting. You know, like, I don't recall ever having a bankruptcy case where no creditors make an appearance.
Well, before we move on from Flu's, I just... I mean, obviously things like Bitcoin is way beyond in the chronology of what I'm doing. But I can't miss the opportunity to ask somebody who has tried to do a digital currency. A, do you have any insight on why this is such a tough nut to crack? I mean, there's the obvious regulatory you've encountered. There's the fraud stuff. But also, B, I also feel like it's hard to get the consumers to use it. But things like... Square having such a hard time with Square Cash catching on. But it seems like you guys maybe were going down that road. So.
Well, I think our big thing was that we needed an application. Digital currency for digital currency's sake wasn't compelling, but the gift-giving application was something like, that's a problem I have. I don't know what to get you for a gift. And instead of giving you $100, I give you $100 of Flu's, and it kind of felt a little more fun. But, you know, I think... some digital currency will happen, but I do think there are a lot of headwinds there. You know, there's regulatory headwinds, there's habit headwinds. People like their, you know, habits. And, you know, it's just, these are hard things to, you know, create at a scratch. But I think Bitcoin will succeed in other ways because it actually cuts down on the fraud and... but there's also entrenched players. I mean, you know, there's not just regulatory governments that like to regulate things and issue money. Then there's banks and others who they're very entrenched. So it's a little harder to just disrupt it. Something will happen there. And of course, Bitcoin has other things like just the blockchain, the kind of core protocol behind Bitcoin is something that's valuable. But I'm a believer something good will happen with Bitcoin in the long run. I've made a very small investment in something, in some Bitcoin and some things that track Bitcoin, just because, well, what the heck, if it does happen, I'd kill myself if I didn't, you know, have any horse in
right
on the field for that one. But I don't want to spend my time doing it, you know?
Well, let's touch on, you know, after all that stuff, one of the many things that you worked on, I think most successfully was Pando Networks, and not the website right. Pando, but Pando Networks.
Right.
So tell us a little
right.
bit about that.
Well, so first of all, there are a few things I worked on, Datome and Pando Networks. Mm-hmm. I just want to talk briefly about Datome.
Okay, let's do that one then. Sure.
Because there's history here. Esther Dyson introduced me to a couple of Israeli guys, including one named Yair Goldfinger. And they had this idea that you could serve ads across the internet that were personalized. Mm-hmm. And I kind of got it. Like, oh, I'm an American Airlines customer. I fly between New York and San Francisco. And as I travel around the web, they should give me a banner that says, hey, Robert, here's our special fare for New York to San Francisco, or earn special right. miles.
What is known as retargeting.
Well, so what's interesting right. is I thought it was personalized advertising. That's what we thought we were doing. Mm-hmm. Now, I launched this company here in the U.S., Datome, D-O-T-O-M-I, mm-hmm. which stands for Direct One-to-One Marketing Incorporated. Mm-hmm. Anyway, bottom line is I helped launch that here. I was kind of a co-founder of the company here. It did become retargeting. So, you know, that's what ended up happening is it became ad retargeting. Datome ended up, after many years, getting sold to ValueClick or whatever. I actually left there. It wasn't the right company for me for various reasons. And then I did start a company called Pando Networks. And Pando Networks started with a very simple thesis at the end of 2004, which is all media will be digital and people need new technologies to share it. Great thesis mm-hmm. at the end of 2004. Mm-hmm. I knew the thesis was real because I had just bought a digital camera. I went hiking with my twin brother, his 10-year-old son at the time. I took 200 photos, and I needed to send him the 200 photos, and I couldn't do it. So we started at the end of 2004. We created a desktop app that let you email or IM any size file or folder to anybody in the world. We put this thing out at the beginning of 2006. By 2007, we had 19 or 20 million people sharing files.
I was one of them.
Really?
Yeah, sure.
It was unbelievable. And it worked great, but we had a problem. We were losing $200,000 to $300,000 a month because it was too popular. Now, it was before Amazon Web Services. Mm-hmm. It was before cloud computing. We were buying servers and building out co-location facilities to handle, and we were paying for bandwidth and servers. And anyway, this is really an interesting conversation in the history of the internet and the strategy of online businesses, because our board said we need to monetize. How are we going to monetize? We ended up turning to be a B2B platform. We kept the Pando consumer app but didn't pay any attention to it, and we ended up going after TV downloads. We got a big contract with NBC, which nearly killed us because it was hard to implement with them. And then we ended up becoming a game delivery platform. Now, we ended up becoming the game delivery platform for free-to-play games, where by 2013, we were delivering 300 million game downloads a year. So Riot Games with League of Legends, Turbine with Lord of the Rings. I mean, we were delivering, you know, Perfect World, Nexon. We were delivering 300 million game downloads a year. We had 150 million gamers that had our software on their PCs mm-hmm. for games. So we ended up selling it to Microsoft Xbox because they wanted to put the technology in the Xbox. They did not announce the deal because they didn't want Sony to know what technology is in the Xbox. It's now up on their site. And the most fascinating part about it is just the last few weeks I've been reading rumors that they're going to use our peer-to-peer technology mm-hmm. to deliver Windows updates.
Well, that's right.
You read that now.
Because everyone has a free
it's
update.
Yeah. Unbelievable, which we knew would work. Uh-huh. When they came out with Windows 7 or whatever it was in 2007, 2008, whenever, we actually created a downloader for them and said, oh, you could do this because you were having problems with your downloads. And they were like, no way, we'd never use peer-to-peer, we'd never use it from some other company. Right. But the Xbox people got it. Now, there's one little backstory here. So we sold Pando Networks. Funny enough, I then sold the name Pando to Pando Daily.
Okay.
So I sold them the name and the URL pando.com. They were actually infringing on our trademark. Not only did we own the trademark for sharing media, we also own the trademark for blogging. And they were totally stepping on it. But we ended up selling it to them because we were going out of business. I mean, we were selling the business and closing the business. So interestingly enough, I had lunch with one of my independent board members. Well, my independent board member, a guy named Charlie Fetterman, who had helped me get into Pando Networks, kind of recruited me to do it. But he said to me, he said, you know, Robert, you did a great job. You got this thing sold and the investors are happy, but we let you down as a board. He said, do you think, and this is the New York, California thing, he said, do you think if we had big time California VCs and you had 20 million users and you were spending too much money on bandwidth and servers, would those VCs have said to you, let's go B2B?
Right.
Or would they have said to you, wait a second, you've got 20 million users and it's growing like 40, 50,000 people a day? How much money do you need to get to 100 million?
So it's a social network.
We will fund it, and then what's the business model?
Right.
We didn't have that conversation. So that was a really interesting lesson learned about building a consumer-facing big idea.
Well,
of course, Dropbox came along 2 years later. By 08, Dropbox started, and I give Dropbox credit. We were letting you share any size file or folder with anybody. Their UI, where it felt like it was part of the operating system, was brilliant. You know, we had two other founders of the company with me. One was the CTO, one was the head of product. And the product guy loved our desktop app, and it was a beautiful app. But it wasn't the right UI. Dropbox figured out the right UI, which was, oh, it's just part of my operating system.
Right, that metaphor of literally, this is a folder, an unlimited folder sitting in my on my computer,
was the right, that was brilliant.
Yeah.
And of course, prices of bandwidth and storage went down. And that's another important lesson. And anybody, you know, who looks at internet history and building businesses is figure out the trend and let the trend be your friend.
Or stand in front of the tidal wave and let the tidal wave come in.
Yeah. But, you know, one of the lessons from all of these things, of course, is timing's important. You know, iVillage was, in some ways, perfect timing, build online communities, sell advertising, you're right at the beginning of it. In other ways, too early because we didn't have the tools to build community. Flues.com, certainly wrong timing, way too early. Pando Networks, just probably a couple of years too early. But the idea of unlimited file sharing, media sharing, right on.
Right.
Dotomi was probably on time. So after after selling Microsoft, you know, I had a little opportunity to think about what I wanted to do, and I needed to reconnect with the tech scene in New York. And a lot of VCs wanted me to fix companies they're in, which was not that interesting. I wanted to build something again. And a lot of VCs said, really? You want to build something again? You're like 50 years old and you want to... I'm like, yeah. And I knew that it had to be in mobile. Why? Because looking back now at the 20-year history of the web browser, and anybody reading, listening to your podcast or reading your website, we're really looking back at the first 20 years of the web browser, right? And looking at 1995 to maybe not the first 20 years, 20 years of the consumer web experience. Looking at 95 to 2000, the first 5 years of it, it's easy now to see that the Yahoos with search, the iVillage with community, the, you know, Excite, whatever, that a lot of these companies, you know, people came along and innovated on top. You know, Google innovated better in search, whatever, because tools weren't yet there. You know, community, of course, I mean, whatever, Facebook, you know, whatever. But I think we're at the same place with mobile. I think the early mobile stuff, we haven't yet had the tools to build the right mobile apps. You're starting to see some of the mobile apps that make sense. Certainly Uber is a mobile app that takes advantage of time and location and visual representation of information.
Right.
But I actually think there's so much innovation left in mobile. It's still early. And that's why, with a young kid who worked with me at Pando Networks, we started this company, which is called Live. And
tell us about it.
Yeah, without getting into too much detail, we believe that you should be able, on your phone, to see everything happening around you in the live world, in the real world, real time. so that it's not just there's a restaurant, there's a bar, there's a movie theater, but there's a restaurant and this is the brunch menu. Mm-hmm. There's a bar and it's happy hour and mm-hmm. this is the special. There's a theater, this is what's about to play. And that you should be able to discover everything happening around you without actually even typing anything. And this is a very hard problem to solve because a lot of this data is not structured data. Mm-hmm. You can't just create a bot and go grab it. And a lot of people have tried, but we think our approach is going to be the one that solves it. And I think, you know, we're ready for a reimagination of what search means. You know, Google search algorithms work great on the web. But, you know, the way you search on the web and the way you search with your phone is two different things. Mm-hmm. You're searching the theory of relativity at your desktop, mm-hmm. great. On the phone, all you want to know is what's around me right now. Local intent, immediacy, mm-hmm. these are the things that are important. So we're working on that problem. How are you going to discover things around you? And we're very excited. We're actually going to launch in 2 months or so here in New York, the product.
Well, and the website, it's liveapp.com?
Liveapp.com. There's very little there right
now. You can sign up at least to get a notification.
You can sign up to get an early notification, right. and we'll probably be notifying people in the next 2 months.
Well, look for that by the end of the summer, I guess, so definitely.
Yeah.
One more thing. Do you still climb mountains?
Not enough. I've got two little kids, but yeah, my twin brother and I used to be very avid climbers. He still climbs a lot of mountains. I can't even tell you
what's
the last
one. What's your favorite one, the one that you would say that was my greatest peak that I...
Well, I mean, we climbed Mount Kilimanjaro. Uh-huh. That was kind of great, but probably the greatest one was Mount Rainier. I mean, Mount Rainier is really a great challenge. It's probably the hardest thing I've ever done physically in my life. Mm. It's climb Rainier because... it's a hike I did with my two brothers, but yeah, it's fun. And
I think you did the Tetons too, right?
Yeah, climbed the Tetons, Pacific Crest Trail. Yeah. Actually, my twin brother and I started when we were 16 years old. We hiked by ourselves with one other 16-year-old friend, the three of us, mm-hmm. from Massachusetts to Maine on the Appalachian Trail, mm-hmm. 300 miles by ourselves over 33 days. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes it's good to get away from all this technology and get out in the middle of nowhere So yeah, you've inspired me. Thank you for mentioning that. I'm going to call my twin brother, who's still a crazy climber, and tell him we've got to get out there.
All right. Well, Robert Levitan, thanks for taking the time to not only remember all this, but to put us up here in your offices. And good luck with Live.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
If this is the first time you're listening to this podcast, please subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice. There's plenty more great internet history where that came from. And if you're a longtime listener, then you know what to do to help us out. Rate and review us on iTunes. Because iTunes gives credit to reviews and ratings, and the more great reviews we get, the more people will discover us. As always, there's more info on our website, www.internethistorypodcast.com. The show's Twitter handle is @NetHistoryPod, and my personal Twitter is @BrianMCC. Thanks for listening.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.